My conversation with screenwriting professor Richard Walter continues in part two.
Welcome to the Ministry of Motion Pictures podcast, where only the foolhardy and headstrong dare to venture. For within these humble halls, you may find your heart stirred to join the ranks of a Christian film movement, to storm the world with God-glorifying media. But be forewarned, this undertaking will lead you down a perilous road of hardship and scorn. And so, if you're committed to pursue this life of woe, brave soul, I now leave you to your resolute guide, writer and director, Todd Schaefer.
I love having my ideas challenged. I often bring a guest on the show to test my assumptions and to pose ideas developing in my mind that need a good rattling. And no better a rattler of assumptions in both film and screenwriting than today's guest, Richard Walter. Richard was the chair of the UCLA screenwriting program and one of its most beloved and respected professors. Richard has recently retired from teaching at UCLA, but that doesn't mean you can't benefit from his teaching. Richard has published what I consider to be the best of the best instructional books on screenwriting, titled The Essentials of Screenwriting. Richard also holds online screenwriting workshops, and you can get on a waiting list for an upcoming workshop at his website, richardwalter.com. You can find even more wisdom from Richard on his Substack podcast called Get Real with Richard Walter. Richard releases a short audio episode each week with great information on screenwriting. He also writes articles on Medium, and they're not repurposed from his Substack. They're completely different. So when you finish this episode, go subscribe to Get Real on Substack and Richard's articles on Medium. This is episode 59.
Interviewed quite a few filmmakers from Nollywood, and they all said that one of the reasons for their success is because they make films that their people can relate to. And even one filmmaker told me that Hollywood has sort of lost its soul, and that's one of the reasons why there's such a success. And I've been trying to figure out, is this a cultural thing, or is there some truth to what they're saying?
Well, what is the Hollywood movies? As if all Hollywood movies are the same. They're not.
Yeah.
There's every kind of movie. Mm-hmm. And yet people like to group things together. They don't have to think, do as much thinking. I have traveled all around the world, and I have seen movies from all around the world. And I really do believe that it's a biological enterprise that enterprise that transcends culture and region.
Yep.
My goodness, I could walk you through some movies I've seen from Asian nations that are among the best I've ever seen. Mm-hmm. I don't have any problem as a Western white guy relating to those, because they are telling great stories, and that's all anybody really, really, that audiences really want, as I say. I'll tell you, there's been so much. It's funny, we've mentioned Jesus. Why not? We're talking about faith-based movies.
Yeah.
I believe that Jesus and Aristotle share the quality of being having their names invoked more frequently than anybody else on behalf of things they would never in a million years support. Here are people praising the death of American soldiers in that crazy a cult in Kansas, where was it, and so on, claiming that this is, imagine Jesus being glad that gay people die. You don't even want to dignify it, but the fact is, though, again, that Aristotle, also constantly misquoted and misrepresented. People talk about Aristotle's three-act story structure, but Aristotle never spoke about acts. He talked about beginnings, middles, and ends.
Yes.
And if you look at beginnings and middles and ends, you're going to see. Now, Sid, you mentioned Sid Field, my late friend, who started this. It seems like he started this revolution in screenwriting books. Mm-hmm. It's his fault, partly mine too. I've written a few of them, but he got me started on it. Sid says there are Sid said a screenplay is 120 pages. Now that was 40 years ago, and that's too long. But he said the beginning is 30 pages, the middle is 60 pages, the end is 30 pages. I don't agree with those numbers, but I do agree that they're not the same size, and the beginning is smaller, the middle is the biggest part, and the end is the shortest part of all in a really well structured story. So again, little beginning, big middle, and very, very quick ending. So what does that look like? I mean, can you think of anything in the world that looks like that? What about a human life? It's an idealized, romanticized image of a human life, childhood, and then the big part of it in the middle, and then hopefully a quick ending. You know, raise your hand high if you want to be on ventilators and resuscitators and for years on catheters and you know, IV tubes and so on. You know, the ideal death they always talk about is, you know, she died in her sleep. You know, it should come quickly and not be a long, a dragged out affair. So I think every work of art, certainly every narrative that we see is really an autobiography. It's a picture of the person who wrote that, who created that. The writers are just going to tell that story over and over again. They're really exploring their own identity. And people will find parallels in watching that. But once again, what it tells you is that all films must be personal. You know, there's a very, very famous writer there's a famous screenwriting teacher. He's not with any university. I'm not going to say who it is because I don't want to, you know, knock my competitors, and I don't really regard us as competitors. But he's taught all around the world and very, very famous, very, very wise, and he's written books about the subject and so on. He says all of us, Sid Field, me, this guy, and all of the rest, we pretty much agree that story is really the central part of it. What we disagree about, he and I, is the personal screenplay. You were talking about it earlier. He says the one thing you should avoid writing is your personal, your little own personal story. Nobody cares about that. Assess the market. If you're going to be a professional, treat yourself like a professional. Otherwise, nobody will treat you like a professional. See what's popular now, what is trending, and so on. I reject all of that. I think it's poison. Whatever's trending now, it's too late to get in on that because it's trending now. Also, I don't think there are any trends. What's the trend now? I'm in the middle of it. I know everybody I know is in the business, not everybody, but many, 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 many people. And nobody can tell me what the trend is today. I don't think there really are trends in the universe or in film. I think it's not just okay to write your own personal little story, but that's the only story you should write. That's the only story that you can write. It's being funneled through you. It's being affected by you. Quit fighting that. Go with that. Tell your own personal little story, and then tell it over and over and over. That's all you can really do. And you should recognize once again that what you're telling is the truth. Even though movies are nothing, they're on the surface lies. There's nothing that has been that's more false than a movie. Broken up, disconnected stuff. You know, somebody walks in and says, "Hi, how are you?" And the person says, "I'm okay, how are you?" They may have filmed that one 2 months ago, this one last week. The voice of this one was recorded somewhere else and by somebody else. You know, and yet everything is all mixed together and it all seems to flow real. I just can't tell you how many times I've defended violence on these talk shows in movies. I remember once defending every time The Sopranos. I'm one of those people who believes that The Sopranos is one of the greatest achievements in the history of civilization. That's what happens when great writing smashes into great acting. And I remember I was defending it. Every year I would get called up to these shows defending the violence on The Sopranos. I remember Chris Matthews on Hardball. I was on 24 appearances on that show over the years. he was showing a really violent scene from the Sopranos. I mean, I myself had to turn away from it. One of the Goombas, one of the mobsters, beats up a prostitute in the parking lot at the Bada Bang, their lair, a highway strip bar somewhere in New Jersey along the highway. They show this. I mean, it was really an ugly, brutal, very violent scene. And I remember saying, Chris, saying you showing the clip over and over. You know, they don't want to have talking heads on these shows. They want to show as much visual stuff as they can. So they kept running the clip. And he said, Chris Matthews says to me, you think this is the kind of thing that should be shown on TV? I said, Chris, you just showed it 16 times here, you know. But more to the point, I had to say to him, Chris, it's pretend. You understand that it's pretend. You know, I was approached by because I have an unofficial first look deal with the world. You know, people send me scripts. I can't read them all, but I always look at, it's too painful for me to just simply ignore anything that was sent to me. So I'll read the beginning of it. And if I get engaged, which I rarely do, I'll read it through. But sometimes I do. The fact is, these things that you're reading through, they don't need to be true to the actual data, to the actual facts of a particular situation. Indeed, I think you should take liberties with that. So what you're seeing is fake. It's pretend. But there's something about movies that is not pretend, that is totally, completely real. And it's the most important thing of all, and that is the feeling, the emotion that you feel. When you're afraid, you're really afraid.
Yeah.
I had a friend, rest his soul, he perished recently. We were camp counselors together, you know, 65 years ago, probably. Wow. And I remember we were watching Psycho, and he jumped up, "Don't go in there, lady," and he ran out of the theater. I mean, you know, we're just sitting in the movie theater. I had so I see all of these scripts. People send me material. And I'm also known to see writers earlier than most, you know, than production companies see them and agents see them. So sometimes agents call me and sometimes production companies call me. They're looking to, have I seen anything new and interesting? You know, I'm always happy to tip people to good kind of stuff. So I got a call from the management team of a prize fighter. I'm not going to say his name, but a champion prize fighter. And he was sort of aging out of his career, and his management team saw him as segueing to a movie career, kind of like Arnold Schwarzenegger, you know. And they were looking for scripts for him. And if I saw anything, you know, they'd love me to let them know about it. I said, sure, I'd be happy to do that. They said, by the way, they wanted me to know, they told me the kinds of things that he's looking for, that they're looking for him. They didn't want it to have a lot of dialogue, for example. They wanted it mainly to be action stuff. Mm. But they also pointed out that this particular fighter was a very religious person and took very seriously his role as a role model for young men. And therefore he refused to be depicted, to appear in a movie where he's depicted as causing harm to anybody, hurting anybody. Now, I like to take a big, long silence when I tell people that, because I'm waiting for people to say something. What they inevitably say, everybody has said to me about that, wow, they nod their heads, they kind of admire that. That's kind of like admirable, isn't it? It's ridiculous. Nobody's ever said to me, what a hypocrite, the man beat men with his actual fists, unconscious, actual men, 98.6, with his real fist. He knocked them unconscious, yeah. But draws the line at merely simulating this harmlessly in a movie. My point is, we don't understand any longer what's real and what's not.
Yeah.
Everybody's got it's funny, I was once on one of these shows and I was saying, they were saying this is inappropriate for children. And I was saying, well, children shouldn't watch it. I'm, you know, my wife and I, we didn't let our then 7-year-old see Jurassic Park. We thought it was too scary. There was another couple, Kate Capshaw and her husband, Steven Spielberg, who wouldn't let their 7-year-old to see the movie either. They didn't think that it was, and I was saying to this group, I'm the only person who's in this discussion who is pro-censorship. I think parents should censor what the kids watch. They should know what the kids are. So one of the guys, this is some 20, 25 years ago, before everybody had a cell phone. One of the people on the panel said, yeah, but Richard, you know, now every kid has a TV in their room and it's hard to monitor what they're watching. I said, well, in our house, we have a rule, no TVs in the room. What's lonelier and sadder than a kid alone in a room watching TV? I said, even my wife and I, we do not have a television in our bedroom. Maybe that's why we're married 50 something years, you know? Well, the fact is now everybody has a television in their pocket, you know,
yeah.
And people just don't get the difference anymore. Yes. Between what's real and what's not real. But again, there is something really real in movies, and that is the emotion that you feel when you feel, yep, sad. You're really sad, and that's what audiences want. They want to feel something strong. And I told the preachers in Chicago all those years ago that if they want people to stay in the church on Sunday morning, even after they leave the church, that is to say, think about the sermon, you know, the rest of the day, if it was a good sermon, if it was a provocative and engaging sermon.
Yeah.
Indeed, if it was really good, if you're a really good preacher, what about people thinking about it throughout the week? Mm-hmm. If you want, you want to be a good minister, you want to be a good pastor, you want to be a good preacher, you want to achieve that, to do that, you do not need to make your parishioners feel good. You just have to need to make them feel, scare them,
mm-hmm,
make them cry. Imagine you're walking past a movie theater and it suddenly ends, you know, the doors open. Clearly the movie has just ended. It's broken. And now the people are coming out, and imagine they're all sobbing, you know, with tears running down their cheeks and so on. Would you say to yourself, oh boy, everybody's so sad, I certainly don't want to see that movie? No, you would say, God, you know, I'm canceling my date and going to see this movie right now. We want to feel our passion extremely in a safe place. The movie theater, the space in front of the flat screen at home, it's a safe place to feel what inevitably we feel. There's nobody on the planet who lives for more than 5 minutes who doesn't experience loss and grief. Mm-hmm. And anger and disappointment and so on. Nobody gets it. And this is a way we practice that in a safe place where we can rehearse these emotions. So when we have them in the real world, we've already had that experience. It's not completely unfamiliar to us. We remember we had it, we felt badly, but then we recovered. Maybe we'll recover again. Mm-hmm. So it's not just a diversion. It's not just entertainment in the sense of distracting people. It's entertainment in the sense of intertwinement, of really connecting people with the issues of the world and the issues of their life, and most especially the feelings that we're going to encounter in our real life. I always say to people, you want your life to be boring and your art to be exciting. Imagine, I had relatives come to town last week, and I asked my cousin, so how was the flight? And she said, boring, meaning it was great. It took off on time, it landed on time. There was no turbulence, nobody got hurt. And so imagine somebody, you say to somebody, how was the flight? And they say, oh man, it was terrific. We lost a tire, it blew at Kennedy. And then the second engine flamed out over Kansas. And then there was turbulence oh, what a great flight that was. No. Again, you want your life to be boring.
Yes.
And your art to be exciting and dangerous.
Yes, that's true. Dr. Kevin Van Hooser is a theologian. He's written a book called, a bunch of books. One of them is called Drama of Doctrine. And one of the things he tries to teach his students, his theological students, is you're supposed to be putting scripture and the truths of scripture on display for your people. And when I talked to him, he's like, Christian filmmakers can be an asset to the church by putting that stuff on display and making us exercise our way through those things in real life events so that we're preparing ourselves for those kinds of things.
Yes, I quite agree. quite agree.
That's great.
It's interesting if you think about it, a church, a synagogue, an ashram, a mosque, it's a theater, like a courtroom. Yeah. It's mainly a theater, and the biggest thing there is the audience. It's mm-hmm. the gallery. It's the people who are watching, and they are the creditors. It is to them who is owed the movie. Sometimes there'll be an adaptation of it. They say they ruined the novel. Well, the novel stayed the same. It had, you know, the words didn't change on the page. So really, you have to value that audience. And respect that audience. I'm going to tell you again, there's not a, if there were an exception to this, we could say, ah, that's the exception that proves the rule. But there's not a single exception I've ever encountered. Nobody's ever been able to tell me one. And that again is a work of dramatic narrative that we consider to be classical, that we consider to be worthy, that important, that we perform over and over again, like the great Greek tragedies, like the plays of Shakespeare. There's not one of them that was discovered after its time. They were all commercially successful, contemporaneous with the life of the author. And too many people I know think that, oh, if it makes a lot of money and a lot of people like it, it's no good. It's only good if you know, the only a handful of elitists see it and pretend to like it. I think there's a lot of pretending to like movies. I can't imagine how, and including Best Picture Oscars. I remember, The Shape of Water. Just a few years ago, it won the Oscar for Best Picture. I can't believe anybody really liked that movie. Mm-hmm. I think that people say they like it because it kind of identifies their group. I've done this myself in my life earlier, where I heard something was really good and I saw it and I didn't think it was, but I felt like I would look stupid if I said that I, you know, didn't get it. So I would kind of go along with it. I like to think I'm past that now. And I thought that, for example, The Power of the Dog. I want to tell you, I have friends I love and respect who say they love that movie. I was incredibly tedious and silly. We turned it off halfway through. I thought The Coda, we watched the whole thing, but it ends so happy and nice, you know. Yeah. Another myth about Hollywood is that everything Hollywood audiences demand happy endings, everything's tied up. Right. That's not true. The great successful movies have dreadful, horrible endings. Mm-hmm. I'm talking now just about the box office success now. Gone with the Wind, is that a racist movie? Well, is a tangerine a fruit? But it was very popular commercially and had a very, very tragic, sad ending.
Yeah.
Bonnie and Clyde, The mm-hmm. Godfather, Thelma and Louise, they do not need to have happy endings. And I think Coda would have been much better if she doesn't get into the music school at the end. They sort of like let the boyfriend do that. He gets rejected. But it would have been better if she doesn't get in, but she realizes as much as she loves this family and as dependent as they are upon her, she can't be their attendant. She has to go on and live her life and so on. And it shouldn't be that she got into the music school,
right,
you know.
Right.
But at least we watched the whole thing, and I was really impressed with the deaf actors. It's a miracle. God bless them. But what were some of the others? Dune, I don't get it at all. You know, he just couldn't. It's so heavy. Leave me alone already. Let me out of here. But again, I have to tell you, I know really smart people who say they were just gripped by that movie. So once again, it's all about feelings. All you need to do is make people feel your passion.
Right.
Intensely, and the way to do that, there's only one way to do that, and that is to tell a good story. And a good story is stuff that has action in it, stuff that happens. And I'm going to tell you something, Todd, and all of your podcast listeners, that I've already told you, I get a lot of scripts sent to me. If I read the opening to a script, the first top of the first page, and I go like a quarter of the way down the page, and I actually want to read the rest of that page, it's rare. If I get to the, if that page is so good, that writer is so good, that I get to the bottom of the page, I actually want to turn the page. That's rare. I'm going to give you an example of a script I just saw. The very opening slug line, that's the all uppercase, you know, the label for the scene, you know, exterior. This was EXT, exterior, desert highway, noon. That was the slug line, the very first thing in the script. And under that, it says, a car makes its way across, to the horizon, across the parched landscape. And I'm sorry, under the broiling sun, the car makes its way under the broiling sun across the parched landscape, something like that. So what's wrong with that? It says exterior, desert highway, noon. Yeah. If it's pouring rain, you say that. If it's a blizzard, you point that out. But you don't point out what you don't have to point out. So that's here's right. A script, a person has written, thrown her heart into it. And the very first thing you see is totally unnecessary. It's a repeat of what we just heard. It's a repeat of what we just heard. It's a repeat of, you can guess where I'm going with this. So once again, you got to step out of yourself and imagine how it will be perceived by others. That's the trick.
Yeah, that is. That is very good. You write novels as well, don't you?
I do. Kind of prefer it. It's easier. For one thing, you're not stuck with just sight and sound.
Yeah.
You can actually say what people think.
Yeah.
I was actually working with Final Draft, the company that produces Final Draft. They want to put out a Richard Walker template that sets up, and I want to have them, any word in the wide margin description that describes a mental process, remembers, thinks, feels, would come out in red automatically, asking the writer, you want to say this? You know, Harry, I've read in screenplays, Janet remembers that the gun was in the nightstand at the motel. I'm looking, please, you just tell me what I see and what I hear, you know?
Yeah.
That's very limiting. And in novels, you don't have to do that. You can also, novels aren't stuck in the present tense. Star Wars takes place in the future, or is it long ago and far away, long in the past, you know, that we wonder about that, but that's not clear, is not weakness on the part of George Lucas and his writers, but testimony was strength that we want to know about that. Quest for Fire takes place, you know, thousands of years in the past, but all movies, including those movies, unfold now in the present tense. But in a screenplay, you can talk about the future. You can talk about, in a novel, you can talk about the future and the past and so on. Also, novels are longer, and longer is easier.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people think, no, longer is hard. No. Longer is easier. There's a famous letter from Hemingway to his editor in New York. I think he was in Cuba writing The Old Man and the Sea. Hemingway was, and he wrote this long letter to Maxwell Perkins, his legendary editor in New York, and it ran on for like 9 pages, this and that and the other thing. Finally, he wraps it up on page 9. He says, well, that's about it for now, Max. Please forgive me for writing such a long letter. I did not have the time to write a short one. It takes time to do what writers and artists have to do, which is to take stuff away. And I'll tell you this, in my old age, I have really come to a new feeling about writing. I used to think in my early days, you have to create stuff and put it up there. Then I came to realize, no, you have to take stuff away and find a story that's already there. Mm. In the same way that Michelangelo, kind of, when he brought in this big block of marble that he was going to sculpt into the David. All he really did, he said, was he could look at that and he could see what he wanted the statue to look like, and he took everything away that wasn't that, you know. So it's really about a taking away. But I've come to a new evolution about this, new movement in my evolution, and it's, again, I used to think you have to put stuff up, then I realized you have to take stuff away and find it. Now I've come to realize that you have to make yourself available and let things find you. You'll never find what you're looking for if you look for it. You kind of get out of your own way. I have lived, and I'm old enough now to look back on my life and see how lucky I've been. You know, in every way, they say you can't have it all, but I have it all. I'm still married to the same girl I haven't married. We have two children, and the only thing better than children, grandchildren. It's all of the fun and none of the cholesterol, you know. It's also a real blessing to see your own children become parents, become capable and loving parents. I hadn't anticipated that part of it. So there's all kinds of ceremonies, but I never thought I would be a writer. I never planned to be a writer, and I certainly never thought I would be a professor. I'm a graduate school dropout. I didn't get my degree. I fell into writing at a party in Malibu. I'm not into writing, but into teaching at a party, a big showbiz party we went to kind of reluctantly one afternoon out in Malibu. And as we walked in the door, the host of the party pointed at me and said to the guy next to him, who was the head of the program at that time, you said, this guy was telling me about something. I was being invited to join the faculty. I wasn't looking for work, didn't need the job, but I thought, I, you know, if the universe throws something at you, if God gives you something, you gotta try it out, you know, you gotta engage it one way or another.
Yeah.
And I realized, and as soon as I got there, wow. I mean, I had been working by that time for well over a decade, you know, making good money, more than I needed to support a family, freelance writing for the studios and the networks. And I was, at that particular time, my first book, which is also my first novel, had come out. This was the mid to late 70s. And it had been sold. The film rights had been sold to a major studio, and I was doing the annotation assignment. And I did not, I was as busy as I had ever been in my career. And I did not need, you know, I didn't need any money. I didn't need to do anything else. I had plenty to do. What I discovered was that by taking on these extra obligations, I actually wrote more. It forced me to organize my time better, to be more economical and more efficient. Also, I was in, as I told you earlier, a research institution where I am required to stay busy creatively with my own work. Mm. I would have required that of myself anyway. Right. Once again, it's a question of staying with it, giving it the time, and then again, staying open to the way things develop, and open in the surprises in your life narrative, and also in your dramatic narrative. When you've got an outline and your story runs off the rails, let it run off the rails, you know. Yeah,
absolutely.
I always say, but you got to make an outline and then throw that outline away. Yeah. You know.
Yep. That's what I do. But it can be hard. But you get things that you never thought you would get.
Many writers, as many writers as there are, that's how many styles, that's how many personalities, that's how many methodologies there are. And I would never try, one thing I never wanted to do, what you said, was to get people to follow me and do work the way I work.
Yeah.
So whatever works for you. Mm-hmm. But once again, you got to, the idea is to be engaging, having people read something that makes them want to read more. And what makes people do that is a feeling that they get. And it does not need to be a good feeling. In most of dramatic literature, it's not a good feeling. It's a bad feeling. Matter of fact, the scariest movie that I ever saw was the second movie that I ever saw. I was a little child, and it was Pinocchio, the animated Disney Pinocchio. And there's terrifying. A moment in that movie where the boys are exiled to Donkey Island, and they they can't speak anymore. They can only kind of hee-haw. They can only bray and they're trying to speak. I've had nightmares about that ever since, you know, 1948 or whenever it was. Maybe another 150 years and I'll get over that. But once again, you do not need to be calming. You do not need to be reassuring. If you look at children's literature, you look at the fairy tales about people being roasted like Hansel and Gretel and so on. You don't have to tell polite, nice, neat stories. Quite the contrary.
That's true. That's very true. Where can people find your workshop?
I guess if you go to richardwalter.com, there's no S at the end of my name. Just go to richardwalter.com and it'll point you to my manager, my media manager, Kathy Berardi. You should be able to contact through that and find out whatever you need to contact. And it should be posted there, whatever needs to be posted. We've just finished our most recent offering. They do sell out. That is limited enrollment. It is interactive and alive in real time. For those who can't do it, it is recorded as well. I have people in Australia up at 4 a.m. To be on it live. But it does sell out pretty much as soon as it's announced. And so it's a good idea to keep your eye on that, or to notify Kathy through the website that you'd like to be given a heads up when it's next going to come up, because I'm never exactly sure when I might do it again. But getting good responses from it and seeing good writing. And again, I thank God every day that she puts me in touch with creative people and allows me to experience this uniquely human aspect of what our lives are all about. I mean, plankton don't do this, beavers and possums and oak trees, they don't do it. Just humans are creative. Yeah. And if you're not being creative, you're not really fulfilling your human nature.
Yeah, that's true. Richard, thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Thank you, Todd. I enjoyed it. Bless your heart. You know where to reach me when you need me.
I hope you enjoyed listening to Professor Richard Walter as much as I did. Here's how to get more of Richard's instruction. 1, buy his book, The Essentials of Screenwriting. 2, sign up for one of his screenwriting workshops at his website, richardwalter.com. Subscribe to his podcast, Get Real, on Substack, and subscribe to his feed on Medium. You'll find links to all of these in the show notes of this episode, including a link to part 1 of my interview with Richard in episode 58, if you missed that.
Our time together draws to a close, valiant filmmaker. We trust your heart has been warmed and your soul nourished. Your host has been Todd Schaefer, creative director of the faith-based independent production house Glorious Films and animation director at Tonic DNA, where he toils on productions for the major Hollywood establishment. If you wish to support the work of the ministry, or simply buy your overworked host a fancy $5 coffee to keep him warm and caffeinated as he pecks out his next script, you can do so on our website at ministryofmotionpictures.org. Again, that's ministryofmotionpictures.org. And you can help spread the word by feeding the algorithms when you share, like, link, follow, subscribe, or leave a nasty comment on our social media. Until we see you again, I adjure you, in the name of our Lord, go forth and boldly create film.
What we do in life echoes in eternity.